On today's Fresh Air, actress Brooke Shields. After trying and trying to have a baby, after artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization, and a miscarriage, Shields finally gave birth to a daughter. And instead of falling in love with her baby, she felt no connection at all. We'll talk with Shields about her memoir, which describes her postpartum depression. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by Nick Armstrong and his band The Thieves. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, actress Brooke Shields, became famous at the age of 12, starring as a child prostitute in Louis Malle's film Pretty Baby. She won a Golden Globe for her starring role in the sitcom Suddenly Susan, and she starred in Broadway revivals of Cabaret and Wonderful Town. Shields has just written a very personal memoir. After getting married in 2001, she desperately wanted to become a mother. Cervical surgery had prevented her from conceiving, so she tried artificial insemination, then in vitro fertilization. Finally, she got pregnant, but it ended in a miscarriage. She tried again, had a healthy pregnancy, but nearly died in labor. After working so hard to have this baby, she was shocked to find she felt no connection to her newborn daughter and fell into a depression that made it impossible to take care of her. Brooke Shields' new memoir is called Down Came the Rain, My Journey Through Postpartum Depression. I asked her first about the difficulty she experienced with in vitro fertilization.
I think the feeling of failure was the most difficult, because here is what is supposed to be the most natural of all aspects of a woman's life, and we assume it's going to be easy, and we assume it's going to come out of love, and it's going to happen, and everything will come into focus. And I think that it took over 2 years for me to actually conceive and keep a child. And that just takes a toll on you with regards to anticipation and letdown. And it was a much longer journey than I ever thought that I would have had to have gone through.
Well, you finally conceived. Your pregnancy was uneventful, but the labor itself was a nightmare. Why did you need a C-section?
I had labored for so long that it became a compromised situation for both me and the baby. And talk about irony. I mean, what was so unbelievable about it was that, in fact, having a C-section probably saved my daughter's life, because she had the cord wrapped around her over three times, actually. And so I think it was just in a sense, too, that the doctors had so wanted me to be able to deliver naturally the way I had always dreamt it and the way I had expressed to him and the belief that it was possible. And then after 24 hours of that, it became more of an emergency situation.
Then you had a herniated uterus.
Yeah, I had it all. I lost a tremendous amount of blood and there was talk of a hysterectomy, and, you know, it was all just on the spot. And it was very much more dramatic than I had ever dreamt of, where the child's born and placed on your chest and still connected by the umbilical cord. And, I mean, you know, that was a dream that I had really played into for years. And it could not have been farther from what I experienced.
What did you experience when you first saw your baby?
I did not experience the feeling of connection that I thought I would, but I quickly thought it was just because I was in a much more compromised physical state. I remarked at how much she looked like her father, which probably didn't help with my identifying with her, because she didn't look anything like me. But she seemed like a complete stranger to me, and she seemed very aware. And the minute I saw her, I thought, I'm not sure I can handle this.
And as this was happening, you also had your herniated uterus sitting outside your body on your stomach.
You're giving away all the good parts of the book. Yeah, I mean, you don't believe that those things can happen, but medically it was unbelievable. They take everything out and take the kid out and put everything supposedly back in. There was question as to whether they were going to put all my plumbing back where it was supposed to go. And thank God my doctor was conservative.
You know, you describe all of the really frightening emotions that you had after your daughter was born. You write, "I felt no connection to my daughter and I wanted to die because of it. She grew inside my body and I didn't even feel related to her." That must have been such a horrifying feeling, or lack of feeling, to have. It must have felt like all wrong, and therefore there was something wrong or even evil about you.
I think it's that what's first happens is there's sort of disbelief, and then you keep waiting for it to get better. And, you know, I was amazed that I didn't instantly feel bonded with her. And I think that was a, you know, that was something that I always thought would happen immediately. And when it didn't happen immediately, I began to think it was my fault and it was my problem. And how self-serving was it to all of a sudden make it about me? Or, I mean, every possible sort of thing that I could possibly believe is to be negative about myself, I started to believe it. And then the fear of my of not ever being connected to her, or not ever feeling like I'm going to get out of this, and feeling like I was the only person in the world to not be bonded with their baby. And it just felt horrific to me. Just anything with regards to parents and their children, if there's anything less than or short of communication and love and bonding, I just never thought it would happen to me.
We should mention here that through this period, when particularly the early part of the period when you're going through this terrible depression, your body was still not in good shape. I mean, you had, for various reasons, like swollen incredibly. Your hands were, you said, like baseball mitts. I mean, you were not feeling well physically or emotionally. What did the doctors tell you?
Originally, the doctors, you know, I tried to address that, and it was a while before I addressed the emotions. But physically, I said, give me something to make the swelling go down. I can't pick up anything. I can't do anything, and I'm in pain. And they said, there's just been so much fluids pumped into your body, and it will go down. It will go away. So that was sort of the first physical reaction. And I could almost deal with the physicality of it. The emotional part was the most confusing, because what I kept being met with was, it's just the baby blues, you'll get over it, it's very common, every new mother goes through this, it's a big shock to your life, and trust me, it'll pass. And so I trusted, and it didn't pass. And once it exceeded sort of the 2-week mark of, it doesn't even seem like a long time, but It was a very, very long time. It was still not getting better. I was still not feeling, the cloud was not lifting. And the doctor then said to me, do you think you could possibly be experiencing postpartum depression? At which point I said, no. Postpartum depression is for the people that you read about in the news that harm their children. I have no desire to harm my children. I just don't want her living with me. I said, that's not me. I'm not a depressed person. I just truly have made a mistake. And I was very rational in my thought process. And he then said to me, you know, would you just consider trying some medicine? Of course, at which point I said no, because I felt that taking medicine for something like this was a sign of weakness. And I had never needed it before to feel better. I felt that I could just power through this. And after much urging from doctors and family members and my husband, and I sort of conceded, if you will, and decided that I would, in fact, try some medicine. And it was really only after that, which was almost when she was about a month old, that I even decided to try taking medication. And the improvement was nothing short of miraculous.
Did you feel it was miraculous, or did just people who knew you think it was miraculous?
I think I felt it was a miracle, because I didn't have the sort of the blanketed weight on my shoulders anymore. I then, however, made a very stupid decision. I decided, since I was in fact feeling better, it could not have been from the medicine. It was just that time, in fact, was healing me, and I didn't need to take it anymore. So all my education thrown out the window, and all of my my knowledge of myself thrown out the window, I decided to abruptly stop taking medicine without even consulting the doctor, because I thought I knew myself better and I was not going to become a member of this sort of depressed community who takes medicine. And I had such a stigma around it. And unfortunately, I plummeted so much farther so quickly that it wasn't until after that sort of major, major episode that I realized that medicine was there for a reason, and that there was nothing, in fact, wrong with better living through medicine.
So what were some of the turning points for you in emotionally becoming a mother?
Well, I don't think I had any emotional turning point whatsoever with regards to my relationship with my daughter until I got help. Because up until then, she existed, I existed, we didn't coexist in my heart and soul, even though I was breastfeeding her, even though she was a dream come true. I was so distanced from her that I had no, my emotions were not available even to motherhood. So it wasn't until I started getting help and coming out of this just black hole, then it was at that point that I then started to regard myself as, in fact, this child's only mother. And then come the smaller but unbelievably important emotional turning points when your child is only comforted in your arms, when you can recognize the differences in her cries and what that means, when you watch her sleeping and feel as connected to her as when she's awake. I mean, I think that those little teeny emotional turning points then started to flood in, and the whole thing became this unbelievable connection that I always thought I would have, but it had taken a long time to get there.
My guest is Brooke Shields. Her new memoir is called Down Came the Rain, My Journey Through Postpartum Depression. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Brooke Shields is my guest, and she's written a new memoir called Down Came the Rain, My Journey Through Postpartum Depression. As you point out in your book, your life has always been public. And as you were in the hospital, as you were dealing afterwards with a postpartum depression, you knew that there would be photographers around who wanted to take pictures of you and your baby and all of this. And of course, it's probably the last thing that you would have wanted then, because you were feeling so awful, so unexpectedly horrible about how things were going. Plus, you were all swollen and didn't even look like yourself. So I'm sure the last thing you wanted was to be in magazines, newspapers.
Absolutely.
So how did you deal
with that?
Especially
from the neck down.
So how did you deal with that aspect of your early motherhood?
I mean, I don't know anybody that looks great after they've had a kid. So I was I thought, okay, well, at least I'm normal there. What wasn't conventional, so to speak, was the fact that there were countless nurses that came in. And I don't know whether they just wanted to get a peek or what, but there was a sort of constant flow of just disruption. And I knew that I was going to leave the hospital. And I knew that I was not in a good place. I had no idea the extent to which I was not in a good place. But I knew that if I saw pictures of myself looking as bad as I felt, I would have been even more embarrassed and more devastated. So I got friends of mine to help me with hair and makeup, and I dressed up, and I wrapped the baby in something pretty, and I tried to present a picture that would at least not leave anything open to suspicion that it was anything less than graceful or perfect, as we all think it's supposed to be. And so I just didn't want people on my back, honestly, sort of hounding me about there being anything wrong.
Why is it different to be photographed by the paparazzi when you're not feeling well and when you're feeling, you know, depressed about motherhood? Why is that different from writing a memoir in which you go into great detail about that depression?
Because it comes from me directly, and because it's in my words and it is by my hand that it gets documented. So there's no room for any type of opinion, really, except for mine. And I think that's a rare opportunity that you get, especially if you're a well-known person, or if you're in the entertainment industry, or if you're in the public eye in any way. And I think that whether just to escape conjecture. I mean, I think that there was a feeling that I had that I wanted this out of anything that I've ever experienced to be in my words. And in a way, that was so that I would take responsibility for it. But it was also so that so often things get leaked. I mean, my in vitro story got leaked by a nurse. Would I have become so openly about it? I'm not sure I would have chosen to speak about it just because it was a long, hard journey. But once that happened, there was this sort of obsession with my pregnancy and my baby and my having a child. And I really just, I thought, okay, well, if that's already out, something is probably going to be said somewhere along the line and it won't be true. I might as well be the one to have it be my story and know that it's my story.
If I can ask you a frank question about something, you know, you have been in the public eye since you were a child. And, you know, as we all know, you're very beautiful. And I'm sure you have been the object of fantasy to many younger and older men. And, you know, so there's been this, like, mystique around you all your life. And in your book, you're writing in such kind of frank terms about your body. You know, you're writing about a miscarriage. You're writing about artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization. You're writing about a cesarean section. I mean, you're writing in pretty explicit medical terms about the realities of what's going through your body, which is so different from the kind of fantasy, the sexual fantasy image. Do you know what
That's
I mean?
That's one way to get me off the pedestal, huh? Well, I've been up there a long time. I'm lonely up here.
Well, I don't know if it's the kind of thing you thought about or not.
You know what? I have to say that, and unfortunately with this, men become the least cared about in these things, which is unfortunate too, which is also something I touch upon, is that, you know, there is this, it's not happening to the men. So I think that it's important for them to try to understand as much. And also we need to be compassionate to them about how difficult this is for them to sort of see their wives, their partners in these compromising situations. And nobody wants to talk about this stuff because it's not pretty. The interesting thing is, you know, I sort of rely on the work to be the fantasy, you know, the work that I do where I can opt for different people and where everything's perfect in your movie world and where everything works out right in theater and with regards to recent roles that I've played. And I honestly have never felt comfortable as the object of that type of affection, so to speak, because it just seems so foreign to who I really am. And it's something that's very external and it's very much out there. So, you know, if the risk is being known more honestly for who I am and the reality of it, then I'd rather live there than I would in fantasy.
Your parents separated, I think, by the time you were born or shortly after you were born?
5 months. 5 months after I was born.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you know, your mother was famous in the press for being very possessive and controlling, for running your career when you were a child and when you were a young adult, for making a lot of your decisions for you. You describe her as obsessive in how she took care of you. You were her life. What's it been like for you to figure out what kind of mother you want to be? I mean, your model is her. I think you don't want to be as obsessive a parent as she was. I think it's always hard for parents to figure out who they want to be as opposed to how they were parented.
I think it's really, because those are the first models that you know, and those are the stories you go back to in your head as to what my parents did and how I'm going to be the same or different. And I think it's an ongoing, it seems that it's ongoing in my discovery of it. What I can say, which I found the most interesting, is that I have much more empathy for my mother having had a child. I think where a lot of her obsession came in, and I use that word loosely in a sense, is that I was and we were in an industry that is filled with a sort of, there's a piranha mentality. There's sort of, you eat your young and you sort of, you get devoured so easily. And you hear about the stories of these young performers that end up truly lost and truly they've succumbed to so many of the pressures. And one of the reasons why I do, in a sense, appreciate her obsessiveness with regards to being that which stands between me and everybody else is that I was relatively unscathed by what is so negative about the business that I was in. Where I feel it hindered me was in this sort of unbelievable naivete that seemed to maintain itself in my life because I never really fought too many of the battles on my own. I really wasn't sure what my own voice was and where my strengths were. And I think that I understand how that happened, and I also understand that she did the best she could. The irony is I look at my daughter and, you know, she's older than I was when I started working, the little slacker. and I would kill for her. I mean, I understand this. I mean, she is so much a part of my fabric at this point that I would get in between her and any type of harm at any moment. And I think that's what, you know, but because my mother was the sort of the infamous one and the famous one, we immediately go to the negative. And I believe I could have been much more harmed by being so young and being in this industry had I not been so sort of primally protected.
Brooke Shields' new memoir is called Down Came the Rain, My Journey Through Postpartum Depression. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Selecting the Pope, Uncovering the Mysteries of Papal Elections by Greg Tobin, available in stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Warner Home Video, announcing controversial classics, 7 new-to-DVD films, including The Americanization of Emily, starring Julie Andrews, on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how playing a child prostitute in the Louis Malle film Pretty Baby changed Brooke Shields' life. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Greatest White Liar, the debut album by Nick Armstrong and his band, The Thieves. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Brooke Shields. She's been modeling and acting just about her whole life. She made the movies King of the Gypsies and Pretty Baby before becoming a teenager. She won a Golden Globe for her starring role in the sitcom Suddenly Susan, which debuted in 1996. More recently, she starred in Broadway revivals of Cabaret and Wonderful Town. Now she's written a memoir called Down Came the Rain about her experience a couple of years ago with postpartum depression. Your daughter is older now than you were when you started to work. At the age of one, you were in an Ivory Snow ad. Would you describe the ad?
I was evidently called in later. My mother was a friend of the photographer, and it was Scavullo, which kind of was an amazing thing. But he called her and said, could you bring the baby down here? Because all these kids are screaming and crying, and none of them know how to kiss. And evidently at 11 months old, I evidently knew how to kiss. I got down there, of course, after I'd had my nap and after I'd eaten. So I was in a happy mood. And basically they just they handed me this bar of soap, and they just kept saying, you know, give it to your mom. And I had a sort of this new fake mom. The picture is just basically of a profile of mine and this woman that is supposed to be my mother. And it's all for Ivory Soap.
Did you always, since you were working when you were so young, did you always have a sense of the difference between real life and how drab or boring or chaotic real life could be, and photos and movies, which could create a more intensified or perfected or focused sense of things?
I think I always knew the difference because I never left school to get a high school equivalency or diploma or anything like that. I always stayed in school, and the movies that I made and the work that I did was primarily during my summer breaks. So the sort of vast, the contrast between the two was always very obvious to me. But I think that ever since I was a very little girl, I had a very strong imagination and could so easily just, my mind could just go, and I could leave completely and go into movies that I saw and later in roles that I played. And I think that there's always been this, I've always been able to sort of compartmentalize. But because I started at such a young age, I sort of maintained this belief in that things were like in the movies. And I think that that's something that also contributed to the shock of my postpartum depression, was because I even played into the image of motherhood and maternity. And, you know, I remember the movies that I've seen, or the scenes from movies and pictures that I've seen. And so I think that although my imagination was very sort of strong and I was able to sort of lose myself in these images, they in fact created such a stark contrast much later in life.
Oh my gosh, that Ivory Snow ad that you were talking about is a perfect example. One of the first things you did in this world was participate in this perfected image of motherhood with no mother and baby.
It's another, I mean, if you see me giving her a bath, it is just, it's a mess. You know, there's no handing of the soap over to your mother. There's no, you know, there's no gazing at your mother as a one-year-old saying, you know, thank you, mother, for washing me. I mean, it's just, I started pretty young. It's amazing I'm not more messed up.
At what point did you realize that you were beautiful, and what difference did that make? How did that matter to you in life?
It's one thing to be told you're beautiful, and it's the claim is made that you're beautiful. But beauty is such an arbitrary, it's just such an arbitrary concept. I mean, I, at such a young age, would put on outfits and be photographed in them, or put on makeup or put on something, be photographed in it, take it off, and go back to my life. And even if that was on a daily basis, it was like a sport to me. So I never really equated who I really was with what was said of the photos or the roles or the pictures. And so I always sort of, maybe it was just in this, it was almost avaricious in the way that I refused in my mind to be what anybody said I was, because it just seemed too strange to be labeled the face of the 80s or whatever it was. It just didn't make any sense to me. And it still is sort of very arbitrary in how all these things are decided. I felt that certain pictures looked pretty, but there's a big difference between that and really feeling beautiful yourself. And being so used to other people looking at me, looking at myself in a mirror, or spending any time regarding my own image just seemed like a waste of time, and it seemed like it was always something I avoided. I mean, even in dance class, I had a hard time spotting myself in the mirror, and which you need to do if you want to turn, and never became very good at it because it was such a sort of frightening thing for me to just look at myself, because it seemed that it had been done too much. I think it wasn't until I actually became probably pregnant that I think I really started to, because it started to become less about me and more about a woman, that I then started to really say that I thought that there was beauty in what I saw. And I looked at myself so much more after I got pregnant than I ever really did prior.
Well, you were changing so much. It must have been,
was fascinating.
Yeah.
And so I was able to sort of, in a weird way, you separate yourself from what you know to be yourself. And when you, to look at this ever-changing person and then to see, you know, just there was something in my eyes that was different. And I think that that's what, and then to be looked at by my husband with this look of love and this look of appreciation and this look of celebration, that was something I could tap into and feel beautiful with.
My guest is Brooke Shields. Her new memoir is called Down Came the Rain, My Journey Through Postpartum Depression. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Brooke Shields, and she's written a new memoir called Down Came the Rain, My Journey Through Postpartum Depression. I want to ask you, and I hope you don't mind talking about this, because I know it's something you've probably had to talk about a lot through your career, but the Louis Malle film, Pretty Baby, which I think is from 1978, which is a pivotal part of your career and an important part of Louis Malle's career, and is a really interesting movie. You played a 12-year-old growing up in a New Orleans brothel where your mother works, and your mother was played by Susan Sarandon. And this was a very controversial...
Who now could not play my mother, ironically.
What do you mean?
She could. I mean, she's so beautiful and young. Now it wouldn't make sense if I was to be her daughter. I just think it's interesting. She played my mother twice in King of the Gypsies as well.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, so now we sort of laugh about that. But I'm sorry.
Well, anyway, so in this movie... You play a 12-year-old growing up in a brothel, and although the film isn't explicit, there's things like your virginity is auctioned off to the men at the brothel. There are scenes in which you're watching adults having sex. And because you were very young when you made it, what, about 13 or something?
11.
11, wow.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was, my 12th birthday.
There was a lot of controversy in the press where like you being exposed through this movie to things you shouldn't have been exposed to. Was your mother right or wrong in allowing you to be in it? What impact was it going to have on your life? Was Louis Malle wrong in making such a film? Blah, 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 blah. So, like, did you understand what was going on in the movie then?
It's interesting because it was an incredibly important movie in my life overall. I mean, so much so that I wrote my thesis at Princeton on it. Not just that film, but on La Comédie, which was another movie that Louis did with sort of exploring similar themes. And what's interesting now is that it's a mild movie in comparison to movies nowadays. And I was 11. I had my 12th birthday on the film set. And I grew up in Manhattan, you know, so I grew up knowing what 42nd Street looked like, seeing sort of the decadence of the city and seeing sort of poverty and prostitution and all of that. And nothing very pretty about it, actually. It was just, you know, you grow up in the city and it was just my mom and I, and she was always very open to me about what I saw and what it was. And then to make a film and to work with a director, I don't think I knew how incredible it was to work with Louis Malle at that young an age. But what I did know is that the beauty of the movie, cinematically and the costumes and the age, that there was no sense of debauchery or there was nothing sort of dirty about the way the story was told. And therefore, I was not uncomfortable by it, nor did I feel that it was something that was inappropriate. I mean, to me, it seemed beautiful. Now, naive or not, the artistic value of working with Louis Malle and of sort of touching upon a very controversial but true story was something that I don't think any of us ever really questioned, and I still don't question it.
You know, we were talking about what it's like to be photographed and, you know, by still photographers and by movie directors. In a way, that's an issue within Pretty Baby because, you know, Keith Carradine plays a photographer who likes to photograph prostitutes. And then, you know, you kind of fall in love with each other and you become his muse. He photographs, dresses you up and photographs you. So, you know, the movie is in part about being the subject of a photographer's gaze. Let me play a scene from Pretty Baby. And in this scene, Keith Carradine, as the photographer, Balak, walks into his bedroom and finds you in his bed. And you tell him that you want to be his lover.
I'm going to make you so happy. You're just my kind of man. You really are. I'm really good, you know, Cherie.
Don't talk to me like that, please. Don't talk like a whore.
What do you want me to say? I feel something inside me, so I say it. When you go away, it hurts me. Right here.
You're only hungry, perhaps.
And what's wrong with whores anyhow? I thought you liked us.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry.
Everybody says I'm pretty. I'm getting to be filled out soon. And all the other men like me. Don't you like me?
Brooke Shields, looking back, do you think that this scene might have been difficult for Keith Carradine to do?
You know, he has such integrity, and his love and his respect for me just as a person really was I think stemmed from what he knew to be true of the story between these two people and it being a true story. Anything that he did it with a level of kindness and sort of unavoidable affection. You know, in those days too, the age difference was not as sort of focused on as it is today, and right and wrong with regards to relations and relationships, and especially in New Orleans in the 1900s, it was very, very different then. So I think his ability to be moved by this, the innocence of this young girl, and she was very forthright, even if she was parroting what she heard other women say or what she heard her mother say or what she saw to be true, there was this, it seemed to have all been reduced very quickly to simply these two people and the emotions that they felt. Now, whether for the young girl it was more transient or more, you know, what a whim, and whether it was for him it was something more important and sort of more in depth, I would say, that I think was coming through his character. So he never... You know, Keith never seemed uncomfortable around me, and he always made me feel very safe. And I never felt like he was taking advantage of the situation. I felt that he was being very true to the love that he really did feel as a character for this very young woman.
Just one more question about the film. Do you feel like you lost any of your innocence working on the film, or that you learned about things you otherwise wouldn't have known about at that age?
Not in terms of sexuality, and by no means. But I think that, you know, I thought movies were much more fun. I assumed they would be easier to make. I didn't assume that they would be 14, 16-hour days and that I would be tired and hot and uncomfortable. And, you know, I mean, I think that I lost my innocence with regards to the fantasy of filmmaking.
Right.
That's for sure.
I want to ask you about your husband, Chris Henchy, who you write about a lot in your new memoir. He's a comedy writer. What's he writing for now?
He's currently writing Entourage. Then he's writing a film for Universal for Will Ferrell, Land of the Lost. He was writing that movie.
So I've always wondered, when your husband's a comedy writer, is he funny at home? You know how, like, some comedy writers are actually really depressed most of the time and not necessarily funny?
Most stand-up comics are really depressed. But no, he's funny all throughout the day. And he's got a wry sense of humor that is just, it sort of doesn't infringe, and yet it makes everything, heavier situations seem a little bit lighter, and lighter situations even funnier.
Was there a point during your postpartum depression that he stopped being funny, that things had gotten so bad that he just wasn't funny anymore? And was that a clue for you that things were really out of control?
You know, postpartum depression is a very self-absorbed place that you get to. And I would have been hard-pressed to really care about anybody else's emotions at that time because my situation seemed so dire to me. But I will say now, especially in hindsight, there was a huge gap. There's a huge sort of place in which he had lost his humor. And he had lost a great deal of confidence in me in the sense that he was afraid that he didn't have the answers and that he didn't know what was going on. And there's very little room for humor there because he didn't know where he was standing. And I think that, and then at the same time, he was having to be Mr. Mom to an infant. And I think it was such a shock to his system as well that it took a while for him to get his sense of humor back. I mean, it took a while for him to be able to make fun of me again, which is, unfortunately, for me, a great deal of his sense of humor. but I have to admit, it's always funny. But the way he would make fun of me and sort of, I used to love that and I still love it. There was a period when he was even afraid to do that. And it was just because you didn't know what was going to send me over the edge.
Are you confident that the postpartum depression was the depression that would only exist during the postpartum period and that you're not going to go through a repeat episode of depression unrelated to childbirth?
Having not had any history of depression myself, and this being the first place in which it has creeped in, I'm not concerned. I think the concern is much more for when I have my next child. And I think that I'm much more focused on that. You know, I've never had it before. However, if this has opened up some type of brain passage, or if this has now sort of opened up something within me that is now, you know, something to watch, I at least know what to look for and how not to stay in it for any length of time, how to get the help that I need.
And I think I heard you say, when I have my next child. Reading this book, I wasn't sure I'd ever hear you say that because it was such a really bad experience. It sounded like you would probably choose to never have a second child.
But part of what made it so bad is the lack of knowledge that I have of the possibility that it could exist. I mean, now that I know that there are medications to take that are safe during the third trimester, that there are medications safe for breastfeeding, I know what the signs to look for are. I know that anything in excess of 2 weeks is something I have to pay close attention to with regards to unhappiness after childbirth. I am less afraid because I now have the power of knowledge on my side, and I have people around me that have seen me go through it, seen me before, during, and after, and have understood why, and they remain my support team. So I can't wait to have another baby, and if I start to feel like I'm going down that road again, well, I know what my resources are now.
So how old is your baby now, and how are you feeling now?
Rowan will be 2 the 15th of May, and she is the light of my life. She's hysterical. She's so funny. She amazes me every day. I have been for quite some time now, feeling what I had thought that I always would feel with regards to the joy of motherhood and how everything is worth it.
Brooke Shields, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Brooke Shields' new memoir is called Down Came the Rain, My Journey Through Postpartum Depression. She's now starring in a production of Chicago in London's West End. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the debut CD by Nick Armstrong and the Thieves, a British band that evokes Beatles-era pop. This is Fresh Air. Nick Armstrong is a 25-year-old from England with an uncanny knack for making new rock music that harks back to Beatles-era pop. He and his band, The Thieves, performed at this year's annual South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin and caused a stir with their exuberant energy. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Armstrong's debut album, The Greatest White Liar.
What distinguishes someone who builds on a tradition from someone who merely imitates it? Well, to begin with, you have to convey an understanding and mastery of that tradition without weighing it down with self-consciousness or irony. And it helps if you can add something to the tradition that you're nodding to as well. Nick Armstrong succeeds on both counts. No current pop rocker can so uncannily reproduce the kind of music that was coming out of England in the early 60s. The song I just played, I Can't Stand It, is a good Beatles-style rave-up, while this tune, Broken Mouth Blues, features Armstrong doing a tart send-up of the young Mick Jagger.
I got my eyes on your charm when you hold that thread to my throat. Looking at all the corners in the room, trying to find an angle that will work. Gonna take somebody else to get me to come back to you.
The music made by Nick Armstrong and the Thieves has a buoyancy, a cavalier recklessness, that frees it from the stiffness of too many bands that look backward and never move forward commercially. Whereas bands of a previous generation, ranging from Big Star to the Flamin' Groovies, always struggled to ape the sound they love while trying to let you know that they were in on the joke, the music is no joke to Nick Armstrong. He recognizes that the stuff, not just by the Beatles and the Stones, but also the Dave Clark Five, the Animals, and American groups like the Mamas and the Papas and the Standells, had a core of urgency and almost desperate earnestness. On an original song like On a Promise, Armstrong sings about the morning after a night spent with his true love, with both realistic details and a nice romantic fuzziness.
Can't you wait and see what you're doing to me? Tease me now, you might as well lock me out. Like a big old thighs or even four on my brow. If you tease me now, ain't you getting weak?
To be sure, there are times when Armstrong and the Thieves, so confident as they are about their powers to summon up the sound of a bygone era, can't help but toss in a clever homage. Listen to a bit of Down Home Girl and tell me where the guitar riff comes from. Okay, everyone who said Donovan's Sunshine Superman, raise your hands. It's fun, isn't it? Yet it's not all fun. Armstrong knows that underpinning a lot of the best music of the 60s was a demand for freedom, for self-respect, for the chance to take your place on the stage of the world. Much of that sentiment comes across on a vehement song like Back in That Room.
You have done nothing all day now. You got absolutely nothing to say.
I understand that in their live shows, the rest of the Thieves share lead vocals with Armstrong, and I'll bet that's pretty amusing. But right now, on this record, all I want to hear is the precociously scratchy, wasted, gopher-broke holler and croon of Nick Armstrong. He sounds like he wants to conquer love, conquer the world, or explode trying.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed The Greatest White Liar by Nick Armstrong and the Thieves. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Henry Boldenato, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
If I twist your arm for me, I'll put my neck on the line for you. If I twist your arm for me, I'll put my neck on the line for you. I'll never know if the sun will shine down and who'd have put money on our love going wrong. All that you know if you need to cry is that my shoulder's there for you to cry on, to ease off.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Dialogues by Stephen Spignesi, a novel in conversations between an accused murderer and her court-appointed psychiatrist. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with composer and conductor Pierre Boulez. His 80th birthday is being celebrated this year with concerts and recordings. Also, journalist David Enders tells us about going to Baghdad in 2003 at the age of 22 and starting the English-language newspaper, The Baghdad Bulletin. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with composer and conductor Pierre Boulez. His 80th birthday is being celebrated this year with concerts and recordings. Also, journalist David Enders tells us about going to Baghdad in 2003 at the age of 22 and starting the English language newspaper, The Baghdad Bulletin. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with composer and conductor Pierre Boulez. His 80th birthday is being celebrated this year with concerts and recordings. Also, journalist David Enders tells us about going to Baghdad in 2003 at the age of 22 and starting the English language newspaper, The Baghdad Bulletin. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.